If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
You've been listening to Creed from Spaga, a trio making interesting stripped-down acoustic jazz music featuring Aaron Magner on piano. Of course, you know Aaron from his other prominent project, The Disco Biscuits, but as luck would have it, he has carved out some time to get back to his original passion, jazz piano. He created this project as an ode to his humble beginnings and wanted to test the limits of his abilities and those of his cohorts on this project. For my ears, at least, sounds like they've done a great job. We caught up with Aaron to talk about Spaga, and our conversation started when I asked Aaron about his formal training on piano.
I started off as a kid playing classical piano. My next door neighbor was the neighborhood piano teacher, and then kind of got disinterested in it by the age of 10 and stopped playing piano for a couple of years, and then decided that I wanted to start playing piano again when I was about 12, and found a teacher and started playing classical again with him. And then he introduced me to jazz, actually. And the second that he introduced me to jazz, I was like, oh, this I like. I don't want to do that classical thing anymore that I wasn't liking. And I kind of started immersing myself in that. And then, you know, continued with some studies, I guess. You know, through different teachers on somewhat a little bit of an academic level as well. Right. Went to like Eastman School of Music in Rochester for a summer when I was in high school. And I eventually declared music as a major at the University of Pennsylvania, though, you know, I was trying to find something that interested me as much as music. I was really trying to find a different major. And finally, it was like, okay, I guess I'll just do this music thing. And, you know, then the Disco Biscuits did our first tour my junior year of college, and I was able to convince my professors that I don't necessarily need to be there for class, but I'll continue with the classwork. And because they were music professors, you know, they were kind of cool with it as I went on tour and did a little bit of work from the road. And by the time my senior year rolled around, I was like, I probably can't do that again. That seemed like a one-time get out of jail free card, as opposed to, like, you know, continuing junior and senior year and somehow accruing credits from the road as a touring musician. So dropped out of school my senior year and kind of never looked back. And then went, like, you know, full-court press with the Disco Biscuits and kind of dropped the, you know, playing piano thing and thinking of myself as a jazz piano player, and got really into learning to play in a rock band. I'd never really been in a rock band before. So, you know, the Disco Biscuits was kind of my first experience with that, of playing, you know, chords that didn't have as much color, you know, didn't have sharp nines and flat nines and sharp 11s and all these chords that you hear in jazz that gives it so much, you know, color to them. And learning how to play rock music, and for that matter, you know, our version of electronic music, of trance fusion, if you will. And then kind of like fully dedicated myself to the Disco Biscuits for, you know, it's still, you know, however many decades later. And that's what's so cool to me, to go back to your original question about this Spaga project, is that it's kind of reconnecting me to a place in my life that I left off 25 years ago, you know, that, like, I guess I missed, you know, I wasn't necessarily remiss about, you know, not continuing with my, you know, jazz studies or, you know, playing piano. And I obviously have multiple pianos in my home. And when I sit down at them, you know, frequently the first thing that comes out is some sort of like improvisational line or chord sequence that has some sort of foundation and roots in jazz. You know, so that part is still in me. But I never really, for the last 25 years since joining the Disco Biscuits, explored it like I was when I was younger. And that's the coolest part about, like, reconnecting to that moment of my life, reconnecting back to a previous version of me, you know, and exploring it from when I left off.
The thing about jazz music and jazz keyboard is that it is improvisational, unless you're playing, you know, a piece that's already been composed. So that part you've sort of stuck with. I mean, the whole notion of you being in a rock band, I mean, where the Biscuits were when you guys first started out compared to where they are today is miles, miles, miles different. And so the whole notion of improvising and, you know, building this whole Jamtronica thing really is about having some foundation, at least in understanding notes and understanding how things fit together. And certainly your schooling, while it may not connect for everybody. It certainly connects for you when you're playing, though, even though you're playing on an electric piano or some kind of organ or whatever. I mean, at the root of it is your training playing classical or jazz keyboard, right?
Yeah, but I think what the disco biscuits do in terms of improvising, right? If we're going to say that the common ground between, you know, Spaga and the disco biscuits, aside from me being the keyboard player in both, is that the ethos of improvisation is the same, right? Is that, you know, we don't necessarily go like, okay, well, we're going to play the head of the song, and then we're going to open it up into solos, and you're going to solo, then you're going to solo, and then we're going to take a drum solo for four bars, and we're going to come back and play the head of the song, and we're going to improvise maybe in the middle, and then we're going to end it, you know, and the Disco Biscuits do our whole thing of finding new places to, like, improvise. But the common theme here is, you know, the improvisational element, which is rooted on group interplay and the group dynamic and the conversations musically, you know, that we can have with each other on stage. And, you know, what the Disco Biscuits have been so successful at is feeling confident, number one, to be able to take that step, you know, and I do pat us on the back for, you know, putting things on paper that might not look like that segue is going to work, you know. It's not like you want to try it backstage because then you're going to ruin all the fun, but like we're going to go from that key into that key, into that tempo and shift meters there, you know. And yeah, there's been times where it doesn't work, but that shouldn't discourage us. And to be able to have the level of communication that the Disco Biscuits have with each other through improvisation, you know, is what really, I think, has helped propel our career. And so when I have the ability to bring that level of communication, of improvisation, of musical dialogue over to another genre of music, but have the, you know, improvisational element be the same in terms of just a high level of conversation, you know, with musicians that are good enough to have, you know, such big ears to be able to react appropriately to it, you know, not just play with their, you know, God-given talent, but actually play in a group setting where it's not necessarily about the individual, it's about the group. And those are two elements that I love of both of the acts that I'm a part of.
So putting this band together obviously meant that you had to find people that A, were talented, B, like you said, had big ears, but C, could communicate with one another. And was that tricky for you to find Jason and Matt? I mean, they're prominent jazz musicians in Philly, but, you know, was it hard for you to put the pieces together to form Spaga?
Spaga,
sorry.
How are you pronouncing it?
I'm pronouncing it like a Torontonian.
Oh, got it. I'm sorry called you out on that.
No, it's all good.
So, in the hyperbole, how would a Torontonian pronounce it?
Well, I was saying Spaga, but Spaga is fine too. I mean, it's all good, right? Well, and I'm actually a Montrealer. I'm a Montrealer who lives in Toronto, so my dialect is all over the place.
That's really funny. Okay. So how did I find the other musicians? Jason, I had known for years. You know, we were friendly, but never really kept in touch as friends. You know, our social circles a little bit overlapped maybe 10, 12 years ago in Philadelphia. There was, I think, only one other time that I played with Jason, and it was like a kind of like an open mic session at some brewery in Philadelphia. And it's actually, I found it on YouTube recently. It's actually kind of funny. I think we did a Phil Collins song, and then we called ourselves Built to Phil, just playing that one song. But I had Jason specifically in mind as who I wanted to be the bass player for this project. I knew that I wanted an upright bass player, and I wanted a bass player with versatility. And specifically, I wanted a bass player who I felt comfortable with, you know, that I didn't want to have any sort of like overblown imposter syndrome, you know, that here I am coming in trying to play jazz and trying to play jazz songs that I've written. You know, and right. And then we could get into this conversation later. Like, is it jazz? Like, I don't necessarily even consider Spaga jazz. And then it begs the question of, well, what is jazz in the first place? Right. You know, it's like there's most of the songs on this album don't swing, you know, which would probably be one of like, you know, the first telltale signs that it's a jazz song if it swings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these songs, they don't necessarily, right. You know, but it is a piano trio. So, you know, to the layman, if you're like, what genre is this? You know, their first reaction is probably going to be like, it's jazz, you know, because you'd say that before, it's just good.
<I don't laughs> right.
know. Good isn't a genre, you know, instrumental, yes. Like what the fuck is that? So I brought Jason in specifically because I wanted to feel comfortable with the players that I was introducing this music to. And I didn't want to have to think about like, I wonder what they think of me as a player. Like, you know, I can't play these like crazy jazz licks that these, you know, jazz guys have been working on for, you know, decades of their life at this point, that they're like sought after jazz musicians. Right. And I didn't want to have that like thought going through my mind, you know, as I was playing with, you know, a trio that I was assembling of like, well, what do they think of this? Or what do they think of me? I just wanted someone to go in with an open mind and a positive attitude. And I knew that Jason would be the perfect candidate for that. So I actually like brought him to my house one day and I showed him like one or two of the songs that I was working on. And, you know, it was kind of like an introductory thing of let's discuss it. And then, you know, what do you think for drummers? You know, I had some ideas. He had some ideas. And the first idea that he had was Matt Scarano. And that was kind of it. You know, didn't really look back. And Matt came to rehearsal the first day. And we set up in a studio and, you know, just kind of hanging out as we were all setting up our gear. And the vibe in the room amongst the three of us was just like really good. It was like, okay, here's two other people that I could hang with. If I could hang with them before we start playing music, if we're able to play music well together, then this is going to work. And then there was a definitive moment, not necessarily in that first practice, but, you know, maybe as we went into the studio a couple of times to record some demos of the first few songs. And, you know, because the recording light wasn't necessarily on and therefore we felt a little bit more free to do whatever it is that, you know, we were doing for a demo session day in the studio, we were just playing for the sake of playing. You know, we had learned the song and now we were improvising in a moment. We hadn't stretched out these tunes yet, you know, mm-hmm. So this is kind of taking it for a walk for the first time.
Right.
And they were able to get to the climax of the song in like just the perfect way, you know. I mean, there's many different ways that you can get to a climax or a peak of a song. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that the Disco Biscuits do exceptionally well. And to be able to incorporate some of those things without even ever having a conversation about, you know, some of the, you know, several ways we can get to a peak of a song, you know, and I don't necessarily think that all songs need to peak, but this particular jam did. And that was my first moment was where I was like, oh yeah, well, this is going to work.
And how does that work in terms of, you know, just the bareness of it? Do you give them chart music to learn and then they learn it and then they have an understanding of where you're going based on the charts? I mean, they have to learn these songs. You have to probably learn these songs too. And then it's just a matter of finding those spaces where you can improv or have some fun, right?
So there was one song where I gave them two songs. The last song on the album, which is called Nils Shapes, has a middle section that is definitely notey. Mm-hmm. And so I gave them sheet music for that. The other songs I kind of wanted to teach them without giving them a chart. I feel like you pay attention a little bit more when right. you're not looking at, when you're not relying on a chart. And everybody did their own versions of, you know, cheat sheets and scribbling stuff down. Mm-hmm. You know, and to a certain degree, everybody uses, you know, a little scribble of a cheat sheet just to make sure that the training wheels are still there because you're scared to take them off yet, you know, but it's just some scribbles to remind you. So pretty soon we'll be riding two wheels, and, you know, we'll be big boys. But a lot of it was just like knowing what's going on, repetition. And a lot of it was also exploring in the studio. So I had definitely more of a skeleton coming into the studio, mm-hmm. but a lot of the songs were formed in the trio environment. You know, I knew the different sections, I knew the melodies, I knew what was going on, but I didn't know how it was going to sound. You know, I'm not a drummer and I'm not a bass player. I did a lot of the pre-production in the box, as they say, mm-hmm. which is just like, you know, me and my computer, and using some pre-programmed drum beats and then playing in a bass line on the keyboard using an acoustic bass sound and, you know, playing in my piano lines, but on an actual, like, you know, software synth piano. So not miking up a real piano. So I had some foundations of stuff, but it didn't really evolve until we got into the studio and started experimenting with it. And then, you know, we'd spent, I don't know, however many days in total, probably ended up being, 2 days per song as an ensemble. And then the producer and I, whose name is Will Marr, who was kind of my right-hand man throughout the whole project. I mean, just like an incredible producer. He was also the engineer on the album, but he was also an incredible, like, cheerleader, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of self-doubt that was also going on the album, you know, of like, this is good. We'd go from like, this is really good, and then like, you know, come back in the next day and be like, oh, this isn't as good as I remember it, you know? And then like, I'd bring the band back in and we'd do like, you know, a few more versions of it, and I'd be like, wait, that first one was really good. It doesn't compare to how it sounds now. Like, what was I thinking? So there was like a lot of that, and it's nice to have somebody else there to be able to bounce ideas off of and explore. But there was a lot of songs on the album that were kind of made through, you know, through production. Some smart mistakes that ended up happening, right. You know, so there's...
Can you give us an example of those? One of those?
Sure, sure. So one of the songs on the album is called Four Angels. And both the intro to the song and then the middle section of the song share this same production technique, which was a mistake that happened by, you know, leaving just the effects send soloed out, right? And so I do this thing both live and in the studio where I install pickups inside of the piano, like mm-hmm. a similar pickup than you'd see on a guitar or something like that, right. And put it inside of the piano, and then I run that back through what eventually will be effect pedals, but right now I'm running it through my computer, and I'm using my computer effectively as effect pedals, right? Nothing to turn a piano into the sound of a, you know, saxophone or into the sound of a synthesizer, but basically to give it these really lush reverbs and cool delays, right. You know, reverbs that have, if words like gravity and diffusion can describe a reverb, that's kind of what these sound like. Big cinematic things, but they have some sort of like weird texture to them, you know, yes. not just airy. They're interesting, where you can literally like hold out one note and like listen to the peculiarities of the reverb sound from it. Anyway, so we're kind of like, you know, this is now the fourth or fifth take of Four Angels. And we're doing kind of like an extended intro at this point, knowing that it's probably not going to make it. And we're just going to, you know, start the actual track on the downbeat of it. But we're getting into the vibe of the song through like a little improvisational thing, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing that it will just probably be thrown away at the end of the day anyway. And when we went to listen to it afterwards, accidentally just the affected part of the piano, yes. the part that was running through the computer, was soloed. So you don't hear anybody else. You don't hear the bass. You don't hear the drums. You don't even hear the piano. You just hear the affected part of the piano. But because of what I'm playing off of what we were doing as a group. I'm playing off of what the bass was doing and off of what the drums were doing. And so you just hear this reverb that is kind of, it's a little melodic, but you can't really necessarily make out what the notes are, but the notes are definitely changing, kind of, sort of. Mm-hmm. And that became the intro of the song. And then a similar thing happened in the middle section of the song, which was kind of like a open jam for a little bit before it culminates in a lick that both Jason and I play that brings us to the fourth section of the song. It's right. One of the reasons that the song is called Four Angels. There's definitely four definitive sections of the song. And that third section right there was the same thing of just like leaving it soloed out, you know, and it becomes this like ominous kind of like floaty pad type of thing, but it's actually a piano, you know, just affected and soloed out. So you don't hear the piano element of it. So there was, and that was, you know, a mistake of just accidentally having it soloed and being like, whoa, hold up, let that breathe for a second. That's really cool just by itself. And then kind of forming a section of a song around that soloed out part.
So when you go back to play this stuff live, is that stuff that you are going to be able to recreate? Have you recreated that sort of that sound?
We have, because I mean, it's one of the things that I do. I install those pickups in right. in the piano when we play live. I bring my computer out because it's easier than stringing along a whole bunch of pedals, though I don't think that it looks as good aesthetically to have a computer sitting on top of the piano. So it's definitely something I want to start moving away from, but uh-huh. it's definitely a lot lighter to put it in your backpack than to have to hook up a whole series of pedals and all that type of stuff. So yeah, we have been able to recreate it. It's never to a T. It's not intended to be recreated as right, to a T, you know. It gave birth to the fact that there is that section of the song that didn't previously exist. And you know, that gives us impetus to kind of be like, okay, well, here's the part that we're going to open up into God knows what. You know, and we've done not that many shows at this point, right? It's been a total of 5 or 6 shows, yes. Public performances. So when we get to that song, it's still kind of a guessing game, you know, of like, well, what's going to happen? You know, so everybody just either like stops playing for a second until that first note is sounded of like, okay, well, what are we going to be working off of now? So like in the New Orleans shows, I set up an arpeggiated pattern on a synth. I'm now incorporating one synth into the setup. And that arpeggiated pattern kind of became the, you know, the birth of what that jam then became, right. which was like a really cool moment that, you know, I didn't anticipate happening. The crowd didn't anticipate happening, you know, and because there was that arpeggiated pattern, and then I went to the piano and kind of like stuck with that same rhythm, and Jason playing 16th notes too, because I believe that the pattern was a 16th note arp. So it was just like a super cool, unexpected things. And these are the beautiful moments that can happen, you know, in improvisation, or when everybody at least is mature enough to go, I'm not going to play right now. I don't know who is, and I don't know what it's going to sound like, but we're going to be in a different place very shortly. And that's pretty cool.
Well, and it does speak to this idea that the whole record is this dreamlike state, right? I mean, it is a very chill record, and there are moments where, having listened to the record a few times now, where you do feel like you're floating on whatever is coming up next, like you're floating before the wake, sort of. And so you know that something's coming, you just don't know when, and so you're sort of chill,
right.
and that
right
for sure in Four Angels, that beginning piece certainly does. And a lot of these songs kind of build out, right? And I mean, you start going pretty intensely by the end of Four Angels, but all of them kind of have this huge huge ending, and you know, parts in the middle that aren't as big but sort of build. I mean, that's all based on your understanding of music and inspiring a crowd and all of that, right?
Right. And it's interesting, like looking, you know, listening to the album now, you know, it does have a lot of like dreamlike sections, right? Yeah. And it is, I don't want to call it like a mellow album. Like, I'm not sure whether I would describe it as like ambient or mellow, but it does have a lot of parts of the songs that, you know, do have that type of descriptor to it.
Well, the other one is, you know, for me, even off the top, you know, Creed sort of opens pretty dark, and then the rebirth thing at the end is so pretty, but it's pretty, and it again is more chill than the rest of the song and not as kind of dark as the rest of the song.
Right.
I think that's prevalent throughout the whole record.
Right. And what's interesting is, like, you know, I would love to continue, and I will be talking about this album because it's not even out yet.
Right.
But for me, the cool part isn't, you know, talking about, like, you know, the album, because to me, you know, even though I'm really excited for everybody to hear it, I want to see what happens with the second album, you know. So I'm already starting to work towards the second album and just seeing how I can evolve this, how I can evolve the piano trio, right? And listen, I'm not, you know, afraid to bring in, you know, a fourth element into this equation, you know. I'm not afraid now to even bring in, like, you know, a synth into the equation. I, like, kind of gradually introduced one, but I was very hell-bent on just stripping everything away, stripping away all of my synths and just wanting it to be piano. I felt like I needed to, I don't know, prove something, whether it was to myself or, you know, to people that didn't know that I really played piano, mm-hmm. you know, that this is, and I wanted it to really be an organic album. I don't think I ever want to take this project to, you know, the point where it sounds like full blown electronic, but my concept now for, like, album number two is to start to incorporate more electronic into it, not necessarily more electronic sounds, though I think that that will happen naturally. And I think that there'll be a nice common ground of keeping the organic and the electric, you know, living together in the same context where one doesn't necessarily overwhelm the other. Mm-hmm. But using concepts from electronic music and bringing it into this setting. And what was particularly cool about taking Spaga to Electric Forest this weekend and exposing Jason and Matt to music that, or to an environment that they might not have necessarily been exposed to before, you know, like, right. these are two, you know, educators, both on the private and the, you know, academic level. Mm-hmm. You know, they're composers in their own right. You know, and they're players that, you know, travel the world as sought after musicians. Matt just got back from Prague a week and a half ago.
Right.
You know, Jason is doing 20,000 person amphitheater tours with Modest Yahoo this whole summer and hopped off of Modest Yahoo tour in order to do this weekend of shows that we had coming up, you know. But out of all the things that they do, one of the things that they don't do is go to electronic music festivals, you know? So it was super cool taking them around to Electric Forest. Number one, it's just such an incredible playground to, you know, be a part of, right? To walk through, to witness. I mean, you know, the pictures don't do it justice. I was trying to tell them that while walking through the forest. I was like, I've been doing this for years, trying to take pictures and bringing them back and showing my wife, like, look how crazy this is. It just doesn't translate.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just like, it's so neat being in that forest. But, you know, these guys would never, on their own volition, go to a Bass Nectar concert. So it was so interesting watching them, like, you know, not just, like, observe the crowd and the environment and the community and the culture, but to incorporate in whatever ways that their musical brains were analyzing the, you know, the algorithms of how the music is created, you know, and what risers are and what a drop is and what a break really represents. And I'm kind of excited now to bring those types of concepts into this, you know, acoustic piano trio and see where that can kind of go. That's the next thing that I want to explore.
So the acoustic piano thing in our scene, in the larger music scene that you're a part of, you know, there aren't a ton of bands, well, for sure in the electronic scene, there's nobody playing piano like this. But, you know, even with the exception of maybe Fish, who, you know, Paige obviously plays piano, there aren't a ton of people who play improv on piano the way it's set out here. And I'm curious about bringing the piano to, like, the grand piano to other things that you're doing now that you're building perhaps a new confidence in the instrument, about bringing that the other way. So just as you're exploring some of the electronic things in the music that you're making and exposing the other musicians to electronic music, whether it's Best Nectar or STS9 or whatever, taking it the other way, taking the piano for those times where, you know, you want to be bold on stage and play something different. Is that a possibility coming out of this project?
Do you want to know what sucks about the instrument that
I
play?
It's huge.
It's fucking huge. Yeah. And it weighs, I don't even know whether they have a number for how much a piano actually weighs, you know? And then after all that, it is so fickle, you know, you have to have it tuned not once, but twice before you play it, you know?
Yeah.
Once after it gets moved onto stage because it's been through whatever hell it's been through to get from a truck to another stage. And then it needs to get tuned again a half hour before you go to like play the concert, you know? And then sometimes in set break, somebody will come back out and, you know, give it a little tune up. But yeah, and then on top of all that, just once you get over the physical element of getting a piano somewhere, if you're playing, the sound of a piano, right, it comes from the soundboard, from the inside soundboard when you open up the lid of the piano,
right,
and how those strings resonate in that soundboard and how the sound then bounces off of the walls in the room that you're in. Right. When you're playing with other musicians and you need to actually hear your piano, you know, you need to mic it up. And that changes everything because now you're no longer listening to the sound of the soundboard and that sound then bouncing around off the walls in the room that you're in, however far away those walls and ceiling are. Now you're just listening to the sound of two microphones placed, you know, somewhat haphazardly sometimes, you know, on top of or inside of a piano.
Right.
And like, and it's really difficult and it sounds plunky and some notes are louder than others and all that type of stuff. And it's the reason, I mean, aside from how much easier it is to bring a keyboard around than a piano, that sometimes it's better just to have a keyboard, you know? And I mean, people were telling me over this weekend, I haven't seen the Rocket Man movie, but like, that's what Elton John does, is he puts like a keyboard inside like of a shell of a piano,
right,
you know? And doesn't surprise me that that's the case. I'm sure there's, you know, efficient reasons why you would want to do that. You know, most of them are sound reasons. Now, that being said, the visual element, you know, of seeing somebody play something grand like that, like a piano, you know, makes a difference. The physical element of playing a piano and getting the counterweights, you know, because if you've ever looked inside of a piano, it's a crazy instrument of like,
yes,
how it works, just of machinery, you know. And so you hit a note and a lever inside the piano, a lever, you know, pops up and there's a weight to it and a counterweight. And, you know, that gives for a certain playability. I'm going to play differently on a piano, regardless of the tone of the piano, than I am on a keyboard, you know. So that's number one. And then there's like, I don't know, there's just a slew of other reasons of why a piano is a pain in the ass, you know. The real estate alone, like,
right,
listen, would I love to have a piano with the Disco Biscuits? Yes. But like, then what am I giving up? Because I like my little arsenal of synths that are around me, you know, three over here, there's two over here, two,
right,
on this side. Yeah. I mean, I guess Paige has figured it out, right? He's surrounded by an amazing arsenal of keyboards.
And Marco doesn't have as many, but Marco has a piano and he has, I mean, not to the degree that you or Paige would have synths and stuff, but Marco's figured it out too a little bit.
Marco has definitely figured it out. And the degree of toys that Marco has, not necessarily toys that he brings out with him,
mm-hmm,
but toys that he has in his home that he creates, you know, some amazing sounds with, you know, a lot of which go on his albums, you know.
Yeah.
he has an arsenal as well.
So the plan is to take Spaga to smaller rooms, unique venues and curated spaces, so that you can rest assured that the piano is going to sound good in whatever rooms these are. And I would assume that one of the things on a rider for you would be to have a great piano that's tuned. You're not going to be schlepping around a piano, but to have a great piano that's tuned frequently before you sit down so that you can play this stuff properly.
Yeah. when I'm able to control what piano, listen, there's many piano companies out there, you know, over the decades, you know, or century that, you know, the modern piano has been around, that, you know, sound like beautiful, but to be able to have that control of like, okay, well, what are my options? Oh, you have a CF4, like, yes, bring me that. You have a Bösendorf, bring me that. Of course. Yeah. I've never had that experience before. I feel like that's something that only, you know, concert pianists get to have, right? Where, you know, they have in their rider, you know, that I will only play, you know, a Bösendorf or a Yamaha, you know, CX or whatever the top model lines are. So it is kind of cool getting to like, getting to know what these different pianos are out there, you know, because they are, you know, unique instruments, even, you know, unto themselves, even if it's the same exact piano, they do have their, you know, unique idiosyncrasies too. So, but yeah, that's part of the fun of this project for me.
You are going out west, to, well, a state that's always been good to you, in terms of the Biscuits, to perform some of this music, and then coming back to the Ardmore in early September. Is the plan to sort of keep this thing small and let it sort of breathe on its own as the excitement builds for this kind of music? What do you see the future of Spaga being?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure how I see the future of Spaga being, other than, you know, continuing to explore this path that we're on and, you know, seeing where the future goes. I would like to see this project exist in venues where there was a dance party the night before.
Right.
You know, I would like to see this project. I think that it is great in intimate rooms. You know, people are definitely paying attention. People are excited to be in rooms that are that small. You get to kind of, you know, feel the crowd a little bit differently. You know, and it's interesting as we're exploring these different environments. Some rooms are seated, some rooms are standing, some rooms are half seated and half standing, some rooms are like filled with, you know, Biscuit fans that are there to like support and experience something new. Some rooms are filled with, you know, jazz fans that are looking to find something new that they, you know, heard whispers about. Some rooms have both,
right?
You know, and we've in the six shows that we've played, we've experienced all of those, and I would need to go back in for multiple more rounds before I'd be able to ascertain which one I like best. But it's cool that it is able to exist in all of those environments. You know, but I would like to see, listen, my theory with this project is that it'll be easier to convince people that like music that they like this project than to be able to convince people that like jazz that they like this project, you know, and it's a wider pool to play in. So I would much rather, you know, go into rooms where, you know, anything could have happened there the night before. And one of my main goals is to not pigeonhole ourselves to, you know, be playing on like the jazz room circuit, you know, like that's kind of deliberate, that I don't want to go, you know, each city, each reasonably sized city definitely has, you know, one, maybe two jazz rooms, like, and they definitively have a piano there too, which is kind of one of the things you need to have in a jazz room, but that's not where I want this project to exist.
Right.
You know, I want to bring this project to the masses.
Right. Right. Well, I think it deserves to be played for the masses. I think it's a beautiful record, and I'm sure it's going to be different every time, which is also cool. And I'm sure you'll be experimenting on the road with these songs as you take them out and see how they sound in rooms and stuff. So kudos to you on doing something that's very different from what you're doing in your daytime job, and and taking a chance that's, you know, probably feels ancient to you a little bit, but because you've been away from it for so long. But I mean, that's cool, right? I mean, that's what being a musician's about, is about taking some of these risks and learning and figuring some stuff out.
For sure. For sure.
Cool, man. Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ira. This was a fun conversation.
Aaron Magner is psyched about this project, and you should be too. Even if you've never listened to Disco Biscuits, or if you count them as one of your favorite jam bands, you'll get a kick out of this project. I'd encourage you to put on the album due out later this week and listen to it. first intently to hear the phenomenal playing, and then in the background to see if it sparks your interest, as it did mine. For more on Spaga, visit spagaband.com. Before we leave you, have a listen to another piece off of the debut. Here is Resurrection.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.